Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has just released its state-by-state rankings of child well-being. New Mexico is dead last, the worst state in the country to be a child. Nor is this much of a surprise. New Mexico was also dead last year and has been last or nearly last each and every year for the last 7 years. What, if anything, can we do? We'll ask Alan Sanchez, the president of CHI St. Joseph Children and this year's winner of the Alice King Award for Child Advocacy. Alan Sanchez, congratulations and welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Alan, before we get to what can be done, let's dig into some of the stats. And I think one thing that people may not really realize is that these are all stats. There's nothing subjective about these rankings. And so I guess I'd like to start by asking you whether you think these stats accurately reflect what it's like to be a child here in New Mexico.
Yeah, I think they do a very good job of collecting empirical evidence. You know, this is evidence. This is not speculation. And so the evidence has been coming from the Annie Casey Foundation, and the foundation has put this information together. But you can confirm this by looking at other statistics, like the U.S. Census. I mean, they're the ones that have been placing us in the number one in children in poverty and for children between 0 and 5. And then they're also the ones that had placed us at second worst in hunger, and now we are the worst. So when you look at the statistics from the different organizations that bring information over, if you see the same reading coming over and over from different sources, you know they're doing a good job, and they're presenting this and they're bringing it. I don't think there's any argument about the credibility of the evidence.
So the Annie Casey Foundation has 16 indicators of child well-being, and over what they call four domains. And the domains are economic well-being, family, health, and education. So the economic well-being stat is it's just shocking, because 27% of our kids that from zero to, I guess, to teenage are living in poverty. And that compares with a U.S. average rate of 18%. So our children are 50% more of our kids are living in poverty than the U.S. average.
Now, this is an emergency. This is a crisis. And I don't see why we haven't called it the emergency that it is, that it is urgent. But we become...
Why is it so terrible to be living in poverty? I mean,
well, because health outcomes. You know, nowadays you can determine a person's health by their zip code and by seeing what services are provided to children. And we know that the causes of long-term illnesses are connected to income. The more income you earn, the chances of you having better health is greater. So we're seeing children then in this poverty, which causes the bad outcomes for their health. And this is like, it's kind of like a snowball. You get that thing rolling down the mountain, it gets bigger and bigger. The problem is that poverty causes the health issues. And because of those health issues, which is new to health, is the adverse child experiences. I mean, that's health. That's part of health. And those experiences are causing children to arrive behind and stay behind, and then they can't achieve. They're not going to read at grade level by third grade. And if you're not reading at grade level by third grade, your chances of graduating on time have diminished. And if you don't graduate from high school, then you stay in poverty, and the cycle of poverty continues, and then our outcomes stay terrible.
So I want to come back to that in a second, but there's another, you've touched on health. Let's talk about family, and there's another really shocking statistic. So 45% of our kids grow up in a single-parent family, and that compares to a much lower 34% in the U.S., and the teen birth rate, now this is really unbelievable. The teen birth rate in New Mexico is 28 out of 1,000 births versus 19% in the U.S. average. So again, we are 50% higher on teen births, and 45% of our kids are living in single-parent families.
And this all creates crisis because it's connected to then income. If a child's in a single-parent home, their chances of having lesser income is greater. I mean, doesn't mean that both parents might not be working, but it is harder when you have a set of parents having to pay two mortgages instead of one, huh? In under the same household.
Obviously, yeah.
Obviously, yeah. These are very obvious and very easy things to explain for that poverty. And this is the big piece. The mitigator to toxic stress is meaningful adult relationship. And if the single parent who's caring for the child has to also be working, then the child's placed in another environment. And so without this meaningful adult relationships, the toxic stress just goes higher and higher. And what I mean by toxic stress is that every time you have an adrenaline flow, you know, we all have adrenaline, and that's okay to have that. As a matter of fact, if you're walking in the woods and you see a bear, you want some adrenaline because you're going to book it out of there. But where it becomes toxic, let's imagine your heart rate starts going up. You know, you hear that,
yeah.
You hear that heartbeat beating. But when the bear follows you home, the heart rate doesn't go down. It stays up, and there's still adrenaline in the brain. And then you get home, and the bear's looking in the window at you, and that heart rate doesn't come down. That's a child living in toxic stress. And the adrenaline, that hormone, stops. Not just decreases. It stops the development of the synapses growth. Now, in a waking hour of a child, we're creating from the third trimester, while they're still in the womb, to 2.5 years old, they are developing over 9,000 synapses per second. Per second. This is the architecture of the brain being affected by the toxic stress. And the worst toxic stress that our children are experiencing is the poverty. Now, my good friends, some tell me, well, we were so poor, we didn't even know we were poor, you know? But poverty 50 years ago was a much different experience than poverty today. Because what's the mitigator? Meaningful adult relationships. And our society has changed. I would believe, and I think we could probably do some research on this and prove this, but if you look 50 years ago, there was probably 10 meaningful adult relationships for each child. Because families were two adults, parents in the home. Grandma and grandpa lived next door or down the street, not in another city or state. Families were bigger, so there were more aunts and uncles. Our relationship with our neighbors was different. But today, we're down to probably 1.5 meaningful adult relationships. And so you could be in poverty, but if the baby is not being, if the toxic stress is not being transferred to the baby from the stress of the parent, we don't have the synapses interruption in that growth. But today, that parent that comes home, single parent, and they're struggling and they have in their mind all these issues, that tension is being transferred to the baby. And it's the reality of our society. We can't change all that. But what we can change is helping the parent to be the best they can, enabling the parent to not transfer that stress to the child and then do the best work they can. That's why I always say babies do come with instructions. They absolutely do. And it's called a home visitor. I call them baby whisperers.
Well, before we get to what you propose as something we can do about it, I just want to mention one more domain, and you've already touched on it, and that's education. And again, I think people have heard these stats, but you really need to squarely face them. The number of students not finishing high school on time in New Mexico, 29% of kids, versus 15% is the U.S. average for children. So, and if you look at the proficiency in the fourth grade and the eighth grade in math and reading, it's there's a 75 to 80% of the kids are not proficient. So what we're doing is we're just creating another generation of kids that's going to create another generation of kids that's going to go through the same pattern. And that's what we've been doing.
And now I'm about to sing it for you the way I wish I could have sung it for you then.
The way he laughed, the way he loved.
He is the very model of a very stable genius.
Trans hate crime stats shock the UK. Mayor Pete holds his own as Democrats debate. And a country star revisits his first big hit. All that and more this week now that you've tuned into This Way Out.
That's This Way Out, Friday morning at 8:30, right here on KUNM.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm here in the studio with Alan Sanchez. Alan is the winner of this year's Alice King Award for Child Advocacy. Alan is also the president and CEO of CHI St. Joseph Children, and that's essentially a Catholic organization. So I want to give you a very famous quote from Jesus in the Gospels, which is, The poor you will always have with you. And I think a lot of people listening to what you have to say, listening to this show, will think it's just poverty. You know, we, as long as we are a high poverty state, and I think we have the second highest general poverty rate in the country, there's really nothing we can do. We're stuck with this until we can turn our economy around. Now, I take it as a child advocate, you don't really subscribe to that view.
Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. I was one time advocating on the minimum wage, and one representative, she was a great representative, she's not there any longer, and she quoted the scripture to me. The reason she didn't vote for the minimum wage is because the Bible says we will always have the poor. Yeah. That's not what the scripture means. I mean, if that's the case, we're the holiest state in the nation, you know, if we're going to measure it by the poor. Absolutely not. One thing, and I don't want to get on the soapbox here, but one thing that social justice from the scriptures tells us, you know, is that Jesus has a preference for the poor. And so our organization has a preferential option for the poor. When they say, well, what does it mean that your organization is Catholic? And obviously it means that we have a preferential option for the poor. But the services that St. Joseph's Children provides, they're secular. They're not religious. It's like when we had the hospitals. It's the same organization that had the hospitals here in Albuquerque, and many people were born there. And that has nothing to do with the nonprofit being a faith-based nonprofit. No, the secular services are brought. So we go into homes with a curriculum.
So this is home visiting.
Home visiting. And you know what? I'm going to start moving away from the word home visiting. It's really doesn't do justice to what happens. It's really home-based parental education. And that's what it is. We're going in and we're supporting the parent once a week for 3 years with a curriculum of health, well-being, and school readiness. And so parents that are having the first-time child, they may be nervous about this. And having a baby levels the playing field. I'm going to tell you that because, you know, when they're just born, there's no instructions there. You need them from someone. And this is where the trained home visitors, they're prepared. They go in with these curriculums with evidence-based evidence, and they journey with you. And then we have referral specialists that connect you to resources. So the average family that comes to us has 5 referral needs. It could be needing housing, medical coverage, food insecurity. And we connect them to those. And we teach them to how to do the paperwork. If they need SNAP, let's get them registered for that. If they have emergency to need food tonight, let's get them to the food bank and help them to become the best that they can be. You know, like, look at our schools. And I'm not going to put down our Catholic schools. They're great. But all private schools, you know what really makes private schools very successful? And it's not the only thing, but one of them is that it attracts very engaged parents, you know? So how do we help every parent in every school be that engaged parent? And you got to do it at the time of the birth of the baby.
So what makes you think that makes a difference in the life of the parent or the life of the child?
Oh, it makes every difference. You know, we have many early childhood programs that we advocate for, and they're important because the child needs this. But they're not when the encounter happens of the intergenerational education. So pre-K is important that child's there, and there is some communication with the parent. But home visiting, those visitors aren't going in there to educate the baby. They're adult educators, and they're going in to educate the parents or whoever's the guardian or the nowadays grandparents have the child with them. But to help them, first of all, understand they're not alone, that they can do this, and we can help them develop the skills to raise this child, to have that meaningful relationship with them, and how to advocate for their own child, how to connect to the resources.
And there have actually been randomized studies that show
many studies,
this 7 to 10 to 13% return on investment for dollars spent on home visiting. Correct?
Yeah. So when we
more
saw,
than any other early childhood
than
program.
Any other intervention or prevention, this is the thing. Now, we think it's prevention. It's not intervention. If we get babies while in pregnancy or while they're infants, you know, this is starting off before the problems happen.
So how many families right now are in your home visiting program?
We have the capacity. I wouldn't be able to tell you today. I could check, call in and see what it is. But we have the capacity of 750 home visits per week. That's wow. Family units.
Yeah.
It goes up and down depending what babies are turning 3 years old and graduating. You know, and then some walk away while they're toddlers. Maybe they feel already confident and they can do that. So that's a very big capacity. But not when you see that the need is 27,000 home visits
so,
a week.
Yeah, so let's talk about, so home visiting is a prenatal to three program, correct?
Yes.
And there's approximately 25,000 births a year. So you're talking about 75,000 potential kids. 82% of those births are Medicaid qualified. So let's talk about what the state, so you have a potential for 750. The state, as of 2019, was home visiting approximately 3,500 kids total out of the 75,000 kids. And I guess the question is, why? Why isn't this program that's been shown to have these dramatic results, there have been all these studies, why isn't the state expanding this first program, this really early childhood program, so it'll make a difference in the state?
Yeah, that's a very good question. 3,500 when the need is 75,000. You know, you look at that and the average of that. And then when you
it's about 4%, 4.5%.
Yeah, and when you see that a nonprofit private organization like St. Joe's is doing 750.
Yeah.
So there's a number of reasons. I think, first of all, one reason is just that home visiting is a new phenomenon. When you think of in the last...
Yeah, everybody says pre-K. They don't talk
as much about home visiting. And you get the bigger bang for your buck in home visiting. Now, you probably still need the pre-K, but I'm going to tell you the whole difference of success in that pre-K is the home visiting, because you're dealing with the parent. That's where you're going to have... And, you know, my good friends, a lot of them, sometimes I'm liberal, sometimes I'm conservative, but my good conservative friends say, what about personal responsibility, Helen? Well, this is where you're going to install that with families. But if we don't spend the money to do that, then they walk into the legislature and they refuse to fund home visiting.
So
it is a refusal. There's some money, and I congratulate them on that. But
so
that's
they expanded it this year, this 2019. They expanded home visiting they expanded it 1.8 million to 12.4 million. And so that actually allows for 350 more kids to be home visited in the fiscal year 2020, which is, again, still that drop in the bucket. And the argument is, basically, we don't have the money to do it.
350 children compared to 75,000, you're never going to get there. That's nickel and diming this. And they know the evidence. Where we do have a victory is that we do hear all the legislators finally admitting, because 8 years ago they wouldn't do this. Probably more than half would say, you know, we don't want glorified babysitting. We don't want nanny state. These were excuses. But now they're all gone on the bandwagon of the language and the jargon. They've learned the jargon. They learned the language. And they're all saying, oh, we all got to do something about early childhood, because this is where we make the paradigm shift. And yet they still don't invest in it. That's not an investment. That's a token. That's just trying to pacify somebody to move away from me and move. You know, I don't want to see you advocating for this anymore. But it takes a long time to change people's minds and the way they think. I mean, it took us over a decade to repeal the death penalty, or something far less important. It took us 18 years to ban cockfighting. So we've been on this road of trying to have a sustainable source of funding for home visiting, high-quality child care, and pre-K for the last 9 years. Now we're seeing some big movements, and I have to congratulate and thank the governor, our new governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham. I've never seen a governor, this is the third, fourth governor I get to lobby, that I see go to a hearing.
Yeah.
The first time. You gotta really give her some credit.
She went to two Senate committees.
She went to two Senate committees. One was a hearing, and one was just a presentation. The bill wasn't in front of them for a vote, but that was the Senate finance. So it makes a big difference that now we have a governor that has bought into this, understands this. And I used to always say, it's going to take the election of a single mom. She's a single mom. This governor has experienced this, being a single mom, you know, with the death of her husband and raising these children, and she's in there. We have a land commissioner now who believes in this, a school teacher as land commissioner. So things are being set up to make sure that the funding will come. Now, they've made some starting points, and they are rearranging some furniture, and I won't get into that because maybe that's important or not. You know, but that's not about funding. That's about the creation of a early childhood department. We did look at, very interesting, on the Ann Casey Foundation Kids Count, the top 20 do not, the top 20 states in our nation for the best outcomes for children don't have an early childhood department. But maybe we're on to something. Maybe this is going to be the big change. But without any new money, that could be the shuffling of the furniture on the Titanic. It's got to have both.
So let's talk about that. But before we do, let me just reintroduce you. My name is Stephen Spitz. This is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. In the studio with me is Alan Sanchez. And Alan just got the Alice King Award for child advocacy. The big difference now, Alan, really is the Permian Basin.
Yeah, so now with the Permian Basin. Now,
let's talk about that for
10
a second.
10 years ago, somebody told me, you know, I'm the petitioner for this saint to make this Sister Blandina, who started the public schools in New Mexico and started the healthcare system in New Mexico. She's in the process of being made a saint. And somebody says, well, I know why you're doing that. New Mexico's in such terrible shape, you need some miracles. It's going to take a miracle to get us out of this hole we're in. Well, the Permian Basin now, just overnight, wow, we've got all this oil. And thank you, God, or dinosaurs, or plankton, whoever put it there, I want to thank you. But we got the miracle, okay? You've got the oil. Now, as we make the very important transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, we got to do that. Meanwhile, while we do that, if you're going to pump that oil out of the ground, you better have a very good reason why you're doing it and how you're going to spend the revenue from it. And are you collecting the just revenue from that oil? So we know in New Mexico, the Permian Basin, New Mexico and Texas, it looks like a swimming pool. And, you know, you can see some of this, the U.S. Geological Survey shows. Yeah, so it's like a swimming pool.
It's found that the oil find in southeast New Mexico and west Texas is the largest finding of oil and gas anywhere in the United States and perhaps anywhere in the world.
It's anywhere. Huge. They think it's bigger than the pool in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And it's shaped like a swimming pool at the shallow end, big, big, huge shallow end in Texas. But the deep dive end is in New Mexico. So when our legislators keep saying, well, we've seen the oil bust come and go, this is nothing like your experience in the past. This isn't the past. This is the future. And you see companies going in and 60 rigs down there in southeastern New Mexico with this kind of investment. And no well goes in without
billions are going into pipelines. Billions are going into the railroad to ship the stuff out. Billions are going in by the oil companies to pump it out. I mean, it's just not like anything we've ever
seen. Yeah, they're not walking away. Now, environmental wise, red flags everywhere. We got to do this. We're going to do it right. If you're going to do it, better do it right. And we better be making the shift to the renewables. But while we're making that shift and we're earning this revenue, we better put it to use. So we have these legislators now afraid to call that money reoccurring money. You know, and it is going to be reoccurring because they don't drill a well without an expectation of 15 years of service from that well.
Let me shift this over to the constitutional amendment, which you also advocate for. You've been advocating for an additional 1%. Right now, the amount of distribution from the land grant permanent fund is 5%. You've been advocating it to increase that to 6%. How do you think the Permian Basin fine fits into your argument?
Well, the majority of that property is state property. So without us even raising royalties, which that's another discussion for another day, you're going to see huge amounts of money going into that fund, okay? So the fund is the second largest trust in the nation. Listen, my friends, folks.
It's almost $20 billion.
It's almost $20 billion. And look at this. We have the second largest trust in the nation, and we're ranked the worst for our children because we're not funding programs. The worst in the nation. What is wrong with that picture? There has to be a just and ethical proportionate distribution for that money.
Well, the argument against what you're saying is that anything over 5% is too risky.
Why
is it true?
Let me tell you why. Okay, I won't name them by name, but legislators in the Senate Finance, okay, they come saying, well, you know, the norm out there is 5%, and they like to compare it to nonprofits. Well, St. Joe's, We spend 5.5% of our trust, almost $100 million, and it still grows, okay? When we under Bill Richardson, they had an increase. It wasn't for early childhood, so we've never done it for early childhood. But when they did do an increase, they went to 5.8, and the trust still grew without this oil boom that we have. So that's already proven.
So what
and
people,
the IRS,
I think,
but this is an important piece, yeah. Because when they keep using the Harvard Fund, the Yale Fund, all these things, 5% is the base. You must spend 5%. If you have a trust, a nonprofit trust for the public, the IRS expects us to spend at least 5% or more. That's not the cap. That's the bottom.
So I think what people don't get is that the inflows into the fund from the state land office, from all this land the state owns in the Permian Basin, often exceeds the amount of outflow, the 5% that's going out, so that what's happening is the fund is able to grow by its investments year over year. And what you see from like 2010 to 2018, I think the fund has grown from like 10 to 18 billion. And the reason is there's so much inflow.
Yeah, there's
right?
two inflows. There's the stock market, and then there's the gas and oil royalties. Now that comes out to about 11%. The average for the last 5 years has been 11%, and yet the flow going out is 5%, and that's not even true. They report that we withdraw 5%. We're not. We're pulling 4.2%. Why? For two reasons. They use a five-year rolling average. So you're using an average that's smaller than the actual size of the fund, okay? And when they do the distributions, they don't pull all the money at once out. They do it every 3 months. By the time you get to the end of the fiscal year, you know, the fund has already grown even bigger, but you're using a number that's 6 years old already because you're using a five-year rolling average.
So we're nearing the end of the show, Alan.
Yes.
And you've been at this for how many years now?
On this one proposition of the constitutional amendment,
yeah.
9 years. And it's important. Yeah, it's important that it be the constitutional amendment because it's a sustainable source.
So
sustainable.
So do you see that your advocacy has borne fruit? And what do you see as the future? Where do you see this going?
Yeah, we've seen the advocacy has given us some fruit because the legislators, even the vice chair, Carlos Cisneros, said, you know, if the advocates weren't here pushing the constitutional amendment, we wouldn't have put all those other dollars in there. So that's good. We're getting whatever we can. But now the future, I think where we see that's changing, and it's going to have to change, is because all the excuses we've crossed those bridges. All the red herrings have been answered. Every question that they've had, we've been able to answer that. We've done the research. We've shown that it's possible. And it's only just that this population of our children, because the Land Grant Permanent Fund serves all our children, especially the K-12 that we pull out of it.
For education,
very important.
Right?
But this population, the most important, we spend less when the brain does the most growing. We should be spending the most when the brain is doing the most growing and developing. And so I think we have a great chance. We have the land commissioner on our side. Never had that before. Our proposition isn't for the legislators to tell if it's a good idea or how much money. It's to send it to the voters. We're just asking you, is this worthy of a public debate?
We are going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank today's guest, Alan Sanchez. Alan is the president of CHI St. Joseph Children and also winner of the 2019 Alice King Award for Child Advocacy. Thanks also to my engineer, Marino Spencer. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available wherever you get podcasts. Archives are at past shows or at stevenspitz.com. Thanks for listening and see you next time.